Welcome everyone to this phenomenology and the study of religions. So we're going to, this one is going to be a phenomenology, then we're going to have one on sociology and one on psychology and so on. They're very general. I mean, they're going to be very basic, very ABC, but maybe they'll be the basis for a kind of more interesting discussion after I stop talking. So if I talk for about half an hour or something, or if you want to interrupt, you're very welcome to. Now, so the key text that we're going to look at is hello Ruby. Hello. Welcome. Don't you feel too tired?
No.
So we're looking at what is phenomenology, and I suppose a basic answer is phenomenology, from the word, is a theory of appearances. Phenomena, what appears, and logos, the theory of appearances. It's a focusing on what appears to human consciousness, I suppose. Or, in a Heideggerian way, it's letting be seen that which shows itself. I always think that's a good definition. So showing is an important word in phenomenology, letting be seen that which shows itself. But then the phenomenology has got different meanings to different thinkers. But there's a general core of ideas that you can identify that are shared, concerned with appearance and concerned with description. So in terms of history, then, Hegel used the term phenomenology to refer to the movement of the spirit, the Geist, through history. And in a different sense to Husserl's use of the term later on. And even Jung uses the term phenomenology. He calls what he does phenomenology. So it has a very wide... And Kant, of course, makes a distinction between the noumenal and the phenomenal. The thing in itself, which you can't have any knowledge of, and the phenomenal, the appearance of the thing, which you can have knowledge of. And so it's in that sense that Husserl largely gets his ideas. So Edmund Husserl is the key thinker here, so I'm regarding Husserl as a kind of the founder, if you like, of phenomenology. And then, having described Husserl, we'll then go on to look at its application in the study of religions. Now, Husserl's thinking developed... what was Husserl's problem? His problem was... Philosophy, he thought, had been plagued by a problem of idealism on the one hand or materialism on the other. So how can we get out of this impasse, this problem? On the one hand, we've got philosophers like the German idealists, Fichte and all that, think that the world is all just in your head, it's all in the mind, or Hegel. And then you've got the reaction against that, from Feuerbach through to Marx, the material reality which takes precedence over consciousness. And so Husserl thought that these are just two fundamentally different approaches to the world, and there's an impasse, there's a conflict between them. So how do we get out of this? So he thought, I know, we can get out of this through not paying attention to the truth or falsity of the being behind appearances, but just paying attention to the appearances themselves. And so he developed this idea to get through this, beyond this impasse, and particularly from a philosopher called Brentano, Franz Brentano, and he developed his ideas over 40 years into a sort of more or less a complete system, and he applied phenomenology programmatically to perception, time, the body, history, society, culture and ethics, and his work is still being edited. We still haven't got a complete picture of Husserl's work. So his fundamental problem, then, is philosophy is played by idealism versus materialism, and how do we get beyond this? There's a good book, good article on Husserl by Stephen Crowell in that book, Phenomenology, that Blackwell Companion to Phenomenology and Existentialism. So I'd recommend you have a look at that. And Crowell says that for herself, phenomenology is firstly descriptive, a descriptive enterprise, not one that proceeds by way of theory construction, so it's essentially descriptive. Secondly, it aims at clarification and not explanation, so it wants to clarify, not explain. And thirdly, it's not a factual inquiry, but what he calls an eidetic inquiry. It's concerned with the eidos, or the ideas, or the essences of descriptions. And what the essential property of something is. And fourthly, it's reflective inquiry, he says. It's concerned with entities, not concerned with entities, but with the human experience of entities. So I think that's quite useful. How do things in themselves show themselves? So now for Husserl, I always think that there are some key ideas that he develops that are very... that we can understand phenomenology through. First of all, intentionality. And our intentionality is consciousness of, that he gets this from Brentano, that we're always thinking of something. It's always an object of consciousness. So there's always a subject and object of consciousness. So that's fundamental to phenomenology, I always think, intentionality. We're always conscious. There's a cogito, the I think, and there's the flow of objects of consciousness, what he calls the cogitationes. So there's the I think, and there's, this is what intentionality is, and there's the objects of consciousness, the flow of awareness that we're aware of, that a subject is aware of, this flow of objects of consciousness. So consciousness is always a cogito plus a cogitatum, or a cogito, or a flow of cogitationes. So there's no content or meaning of thought. It doesn't make sense without reference to a subject for herself. We always have to have a subject. So to say that a mental act is intentional means that it is has an object, is consciousness of something. Yeah, and I don't think I'll go into all of this, but some of this terminology, noema, is an object of consciousness, and noesis is the method of understanding the object of consciousness. And both of those, and they don't map directly onto the cogito and the cogitationes, but they're closely related. So intentionality, then, that's the first important concept of Husserl to understand, that consciousness has an object. It's quite simple, really, that there's... I'm not surprised, I've said it before, you're always conscious of something. There's no consciousness without an object. In some traditions you get idea of the consciousness becomes, has itself as its own object. You get that in Kashmir Shaivism, for example.
Pure consciousness.
Yeah. Consciousness without an object.
Shasness.
Yeah?
You have to be shasness.
Yeah,
because Karan implies the duality.
Oh yeah.
Linguistically, it's.
Oh, it does. That's interesting. Yeah, the two together. Yeah. I've never thought of that. That's really interesting. Did you just think of that, or did you know that?
I came across it in a conversation a while ago, and I thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah. It is interesting. Yeah. Yeah, so intentionality then. And the second important concept of Husserl is what he called the epoche, which means bracketing, the Greek word for bracketing. So it's the suspension of the being behind appearances. So you put in brackets the question of being. And once you do that, what are you left with? You're left with appearance only. You're left with the cogitationes, you're left with the flow of appearances. And he called this suspending the natural attitude. So our natural attitude to the world is to assume the reality of the world. And he called this the suspension, or the bracketing, the suspending the natural attitude that we have towards the world. Um, So he says, if consciousness is understood naturalistically, we can't answer the fundamental questions of philosophy. So you have to have a phenomenological attitude towards the world, which is stepping outside of your normal reactions and responses into the phenomenological mode. And this is why he thought phenomenology was science. He thought it was a scientific enterprise. He thought it was the fundamental science. He thought that Western science had gone wrong with Galileo, as he says in that in his last book on the crisis in European sciences that we read. So bracketing, then, is a refraining from judgment about the existence of the world and so of all beliefs that depend on it. So I do not attempt to doubt my beliefs like Descartes did, but it's a bracketing or a suspension of the real being of what presents itself, and that is set aside. So it's an inhibition. The epoche inhibits ontological assumptions about life on the plane, he says, from the life of depth. And in the Cartesian Meditations, there's a good account of this, which you've got on the handout there. So I think we'll just have a look at that, read it through. So in the second paragraph on page 20, this is how it describes the epoche. This universal depriving of acceptance, this inhibiting or putting out of play of all positions taken towards the already given objective world, and in the first place all existential positions, those concerning being, illusion, possible being, being likely, probable, etc., or, as it is also called, this phenomenological epoche and parenthesizing of the objective world, therefore does not leave us confronting nothing. It's a wonderful phrase, does not leave us confronting nothing. On the contrary, we gain possession of something by it. And what we, or to speak more precisely, what I, and that's an interesting shift there, what I, the one who is meditating, acquire by it, is my pure living, with all the pure subjective processes making this up, and everything meant in them. Purely as meant in them. So you gain meaning, but meaning is divorced from the being, from being. The universe of phenomena. And in particular, and also a wider phenomenological sense, the epoche can also be said to be the radical and universal method by which I apprehend myself purely as ego, and with my own pure conscious life in and by which the entire objective world exists for me and is precisely as it is for me. Anything belonging to the world, any spatio-temporal being, exists for me, that is to say, is accepted by me, in that I experience it, perceive it, remember it, think of it somehow, judge about it, value it, desire it, or the like. Descartes, as we know, indicated all that by the name cogito. The world is for me absolutely nothing else but the world existing for and accepted by me in such a conscious cogito. It gets its whole sense, universal and specific, and its acceptance as existing exclusively from such cogitationes. In these, my whole world life goes on, including my scientifically inquiring and grounding life. By my living, by my experiencing, thinking, valuing, and acting, I can enter no world other than the one that gets its sense and acceptance or status in and from me, myself. If I put myself above this life and refrain from doing any believing that takes the world straightforwardly as existing, if I direct my regard exclusively to this life itself as consciousness of the world, I thereby acquire myself as the pure ego with the pure stream of my cogitationes. It's a very interesting passage. It's probably making you bristle some of that, but this is the Husserlian position. So, epoche, you bracket out, you've got all that, you're experiencing the world all the time, people and all that, and you bracket out the being behind them. And he says that this is possible and that this is desirable in order to gain objective scientific understanding. We bracket out the meaning of the being behind appearances. And you can see already how this is going to be interesting and important for phenomenology of religion. So, that's the epoche, which he's just described in the Cartesian Meditations. The third idea, which is important, is what he calls the eidetic reduction. And that's from Eidos. Plato's word for idea or essence, usually translated essence. Now that means, okay, we've got all these appearances to consciousness, we've accepted consciousness as intentional, and then we've got all these flow of appearances to our consciousness, and we can describe all those appearances, we can describe perception, and then we have a third process, which is the reduction to essences of the appearances to consciousness. So he, in the Cartesian Meditations, he gives the example of a house. You go into a house and you bracket out the notion of the being of the house, and then you experience the house's appearance for you. So you kind of go around the building, or you just come into the building, so it's a new building, and you begin to explore it. And the more you explore the house, the more you perform, the more you intuit the essence of the house, what he calls the intuition of essence, the Einfühlung, the intuition, the kind of feeling with. And this intuition of essence is an important stage, is a second phenomenological reduction. The epoche is sometimes called the first phenomenological reduction, which is then followed by the second phenomenological reduction, which is the intuition of essences, or the reduction of appearances to the eidos. And that's where you get the typology of religions coming in too. So people, phenomenologists of religion, have initially suspended the judgment about the being behind appearances, the being behind the gods and so on, and then have attempted to put religions into categories, into types of religion, monistic, monotheistic, polytheistic religions, and so on. And then fourthly, for herself, he's got another reduction, which he calls the transcendental reduction. I can't spell that. Which is the reduction to what he calls the transcendental ego. If you apply this process to the self, what are you left with? You're left with a sense of the self as irreducible. You can't reduce the self any further. You're left with a sense of a pure I, pure subjectivity. And this is a reduction of what he calls pure consciousness. Reduction to pure consciousness. So you've got the epoche. Here I am, the phenomenologist, bracketing out the being behind appearances, so that I'm just left with appearances as appearance to my intentional consciousness. I then apply the second phenomenological reduction, which is the after the description. So you describe the appearances, and then you put those, you intuit the essence of those appearances, which entails putting them into categories and types. And then fourthly, you perform, you try to put yourself, yourself or the intentionality of consciousness as an object of consciousness, and you're left with the transcendental ego, because that which cannot be reduced any further. There's a man hovering there in the door. Have you got a hand up? Oh, is he coming in? Oh, okay. Anyway.
Could you clarify something to me under the item number 3, where we have this intuition of essence? It almost sounds as though it's an arbitrary reinstatement of the sort of realities that you have presented from. Yeah. In item number 2, where you started out with the sense of being a whatnot that somebody else has imposed, and now you, out of nowhere, come up with categories.
Yeah. Excellent point. Yeah. What's the basis for the?
It's very arbitrary.
Yeah. How does he define essence? Is he defining essence independent of a notion of being?
Yeah. Exactly. Yes, he is. So, he is. Because he's suspended, he doesn't want to bring being back.
He doesn't want to bring being back, so he's got to define it as kind of distilled experience.
Distilled experience,
Experience of an appearance, I guess.
And this is where all the later phenomenologists rejected, because they thought it was arbitrary. And what's the basis of it? Merleau-Ponty and so on rejected all of that. Heidegger.
That had brought the cultural assumptions of his time.
Yeah, it's just this cultural assumptions of his history, which he surprisingly doesn't suspend judgment about. Yeah.
But he must have defended himself against critics on that point in his lifetime.
Yeah, I'd have to check it out, but I think I'm not sure. Well, he did defend himself, but he defended himself negatively in the sense that he rejected this was anything to do with Platonic ideas. But he said it's an intuition. He put it in the realm of intuition. So he gave the example of the house. You intuit the essence of the house.
It sounds like he's getting very spiritual at this.
Very, it does. Indeed. And I think you picked up on something fundamentally problematic in Husserl. What is this eidos? The intuition of essence. What's its justification?
Problematic about our own classification systems, which many of us think are very good. I'm worried now as to what this year lies for us.
We're all completely convinced by our own classification systems that we can't think of outside of. It's really difficult to think outside of your history, isn't it, who you are? But this one, the transcendental ego, so these last 3 and 4, many phenomenologists accepted the epoche and the intentionality, but rejected the eidetic reduction and the transcendental reduction, the reduction to essence. So if you put yourself, make yourself an object of consciousness, if you can, you find that you can't, and you find that what's left is this pure ego, transcendental ego. And then he's left with the problem of other minds. So here I am as a pure ego. And then how do I infer all you lot out there? So he says, I do. I make an inference that as I experience myself through this process, so I make an inference that you over there, he calls it over there, can do the same process and intuit yourself as a transcendental ego.
But there's no intersubjectivity.
There's no intersubjectivity. It's a problem. But there is, in the sense that he brings in the fifth meditation, he brings in the life world, the Lebenswelt, which is intersubjective. But it's an intersubjectivity of monads, of almost Leibnizian monads. The other important thing about all this is that time, he has a very interesting analysis of time, like time consciousness. And he says that one of the fundamental structures of consciousness is not only intentionality, i.e. consciousness has an object, but temporality as well, time. Time is fundamental to the nature of consciousness. There's a stream of consciousness. And the structures that govern this are not clock time, but the inner, what he calls inner time consciousness, internal time consciousness. and he speaks of the protensions. There's the, you know, the stream of consciousness, if you like. This is what I know, Virginia Woolf or something. And then you have these protensions, which is your time Z. You're projecting into the future, anticipating what will happen. Mm. And there are also these retentions, which are the kind of the short memory of the tail of the comet, if you like, of what's just happened. The just past, just experience, or just past, which he oddly calls the pre-intentional flow of consciousness. But anyway, he wrote a book on this, Temporality's Horizon. So there's that's important in phenomenology, which other thinkers picked up on later on.
Can I have a short question?
Mm.
Then does the time exist only in our consciousness, or?
I think he talks about clock time as being somehow objective, independent of us, but he doesn't seem to be interested in that. He's interested in time as a structure of consciousness. He would suspend the being, I guess, I can't remember, but I think he would bracket out the being of time behind its appearance to human consciousness. So internal time consciousness is primary, has priority. But he wants to be scientific, so he doesn't want to be he doesn't want to completely reject the notion of geometry and so on, for example, or arithmetic as objective sciences. David,
yeah, it sounds, when his discussion time sounds a lot to me like Bergson.
Mm.
And I was wondering I'm trying to remember who was sort of saying this about the primacy of internal conscious time first. I can't.
Could be Bergson.
They're right around the same time. I think it's kind of interesting.
Mm. Mm. Yep.
Yeah. Does anybody know
the topic? No, I can't remember.
Yeah.
So that's 40 years of Husserl in 4 bullet points. Now, there's a problem here, of course. There's problems with Husserlian phenomenology. There's the problem of bracketing. That Derrida wrote a book called Speech and Phenomena, and he picked up on this point. Is it possible to separate being from appearance, which is also a critique of Kant, I guess? Can the being of an appearance be separated from it? He raises that, you know, people have raised that question. Derrida raises that question. And, I mean, doesn't it entail the Kantian notion of the thing in itself, which is outside of, beyond the phenomena? And there's also, he comes under philosophical critique by other phenomenologists, but Levinas particularly. Now, Levinas he translated Husserl into French, and he wrote 2 books on Husserl, The Theory of Intuition in Husserl's Phenomenology, and Exploring Existence with Husserl. So he had a great respect for Husserl, but he nevertheless severely criticised him it's a critique of the philosophy of consciousness, because it doesn't take seriously the other. That's what he argues. You're locked up in your own mind, in your own world, so you can't kind of get out of that. And, well, of course, as you know, Levinas emphasises alterity and the other. So there's a direct critique of Husserl from Levinas. And it also could be criticised from the perspective of what might be called the philosophy of the sign, developed by people like Julia Kristeva from Bakhtin, that consciousness is not primary. What is primary is language and intersubjectivity. And the sign systems that we inhabit, that's primary, not consciousness, not what I think, not my own world of conscious world, but rather intersubjectivity. And the signs that give our world meaning are primary. So I think that's an interesting perspective. Um, And also, he's been criticised for a neglect of the body in people like Merleau-Ponty. So there is a sense that in Husserl that we're kind of disembodied subjects in a way. And non-historical subjects, although his last published book, The Crisis, he's beginning to... 1937 he published that. He's beginning to wake up to history, you know. I said, there is something going on here. especially as a Jewish thinker in Germany in 1937. And he tries to trace a genealogy of that. What went wrong? It all started with Galileo. So from Galileo to the Nazi Party. But no, that's not quite... I didn't quite mean that, but... that scientism, there's a problem with scientism, the objectification of scientism that you get with Galileo, the mathematicization of the world, mathematicizing human reality. And with that mathematicizing human reality, you get a false notion of objectivity and objectivism, which in the end results in treating people as objects. And that's what you get. And that if you treat people as objects, you get Nazis, really. He doesn't actually say that, but this is my shorthand. But he has been criticised for his neglect of historical consciousness and history. We've been reading Implicit Critique of Husserl with the Gadamer's notion of historical consciousness. But nevertheless, Husserl is an absolutely key thinker and a prolific writer, and people, all these phenomenologists and later European thinkers, they all think with Husserl. So Derrida calls himself a phenomenologist, and he says that he's standing within the tradition of Husserl. Although he's critical of Husserl, he's within that tradition of thought. So deep, great respect for Husserl. And of course Heidegger, his prize student, who writes Being and Time, which is a complete rejection of everything Husserl stood for, everything Husserl wrote, and he dedicates it to Husserl. And Husserl reads it and doesn't get it at first. Doesn't realise it's a rejection of his thinking. And then of course, so how does all this relate to religion? So the phenomenology of religion, actually that phrase occurred long before Husserl. I think it was Chantepie de Saussay, was it? Saussay. And then it gets picked up by the Dutch school with people like Van der Loo, who took Husserl's method, particularly the epoche, and applied it to religions. Now, he understood what the epoche was, that Van der Loo is the suspension of the objective appearances, the being behind appearances. Now, in Britain, we've had a real problem in religious education and in schools particularly, because the epoche has been fundamentally misunderstood in higher education in Britain as the suspension of subjectivity, as the suspension of belief, the suspension of my own states of being, my own consciousness. And it clearly doesn't mean that in phenomenology. In fact, it's fundamentally incoherent when given that intentionality is the basis of phenomenology. The suspension of subjectivity is not possible. It's contradictory. But nevertheless, this is what they're teaching 10-year-olds. You've got to suspend your subjectivity to understand Hinduism. But if you see what it's the bracketing of the being behind appearances. It's the bracketing of objectivity, not the bracketing of subjectivity, which is not possible, given that intentionality is the basis of phenomenology.
It's just fine. It's like the one thing you can't ever bracket.
Yeah, according to Husserl, the one thing that the ego cannot be the subject of the epoche. It cannot be subjective. He says it very clearly. Not that he's authority, but I mean, if you think about it, it's But I mean, I'm just thinking, we can doubt ourselves, but you can't, as Descartes says, you can't doubt the doubter, as it were, even. But in religion, I think it's been a bit of a problem that phenomenology of religion has taken the epoche to be the suspension of subjectivity and not the objective being behind appearances. There's also the problem of dehistoricizing, that you take religions out of their context and compare them and dehistoricize them. And there's a neglect, there has been a neglect in British phenomenology of religion of the political and social dimensions of religions, arguably. Because of an emphasis on description, which I think is important, but some have argued that that has not allowed a more critical understanding or an explanation of religions. Now we could take up some of these criticisms. Phenomenology of Religion. Then, another important book, which was long before Husserl, 1911, Rudolf Otto's idea of the holy, was an attempt. It was a sort of phenomenology, which is a kind of description of notions of the holy in across religions. So what is the use of phenomenology of religion? Why do phenomenology of religion? Many anthropologists criticize phenomenology of religion. Bourdieu, for example, the logic of practice, and severe criticism of Husserl. Now, you could argue that actually phenomenology of religion is important and a necessary part in developing the study of religions or some kind of objective account of religions, because of its emphasis on description. Because if you bracket out this being behind appearances, we're left with description of appearances, which you could argue is an important point of departure. So within that, you could count philology. So you have you've got a whole load of manuscripts of some text. So you develop a critical edition of a text based on manuscripts, and that's, in a sense, that's a first level phenomenology. Although you are making an argument that the text is this way, you're nevertheless performing a kind of phenomenology. But you could argue that that's not enough. That we've done that. We've been doing that for 30 years, 40 years. That it's time to do something else and move on from that, to ask more critical questions, to ask questions about gender, ask questions about disability, ask questions about sexuality, ask questions about history. Given that you've got a mass of data, if you like, on the at the level of description, and many texts, I don't think it's, a lot more can be done. But nevertheless, you could argue that you can bring in and ask more critical questions from different kinds of discourse, and that it's not enough any longer to rest with the first level phenomenology. There's also a second level phenomenology. You could argue that there's an ontological pressure. You could start making ontological claims as a phenomenologist about the nature of the world, arguably. And some do, Steinbock, someone like that. Mysticism and Phenomenology. Mysticism published about 3 years ago now. Or John Bowker. Then you have... Because of the constant repetition of appearances to consciousness, that creates an ontological pressure as to their being. So this is beyond the epoche. That actually a deeper level requires an ontological engagement that has been sidestepped or bracketed out in the second in the first phenomenological reduction. So if you if Shiva keeps appearing in human consciousness over a period of 2,000 years, this creates an ontological pressure as to Shiva's independent existence, according to that theory. But you could then, of course, have other kinds of accounts. You could have psychological accounts or all sorts of accounts. So it doesn't get round the problem of reductionism versus non-reductionism. But I think phenomenology of religion is arguably valuable, still valuable, because of its non-reductionistic attempt to understand religions, which is non-theological in the sense that it's not standing within a particular tradition of theology and doesn't assume the truth or falsity of the gods. The other criticism comes that it actually gives too much emphasis on insider accounts. The phenomenology of religion privileges insider accounts. And you can question that, the insider accounts. I mean, you could have, a Unitarian Christian description of Christianity, which was phenomenologically absurd. I mean, I could conceive of that. So it's not obvious that that you should allow insider accounts to take precedence. So can we retrieve anything? I think phenomenology of religion is indeed important and a necessary enterprise. But it's not the only game in town. So do you not regard yourself as phenomenologists of religion? Does anyone here think of themselves as phenomenologists?
Oh, I guess so.
You do, you do. Oh, we got right. I do too. I'm a phenomenologist of religion.
One of the nicer things about some of the so-called phenomenologists, and I think particularly of Mircea Eliade,
is
that the man had a great power of imagination.
Yes.
And I think to try to understand anything, including other people, and even oneself, I suppose, is to have a kind of poetically active imagination.
Yeah.
You can become very sterile in your thinking. The worst, of course, is to end up with pure quantitative stuff that you have referred to. But people that aren't as good mathematicians as pure quantitative stuffers can become still very dry. They get a set of critical or not so critical theoretical categories, and you work within these, and I think this may stifle the imagination, the inability to appreciate one's own potential creativity, and certainly that of the persons who've taken these texts seriously, and every one of them who read the old text probably read it a bit differently. And if you're trying to get a sense of that, you work.
It's terribly important.
But that is the problem, how you control and check your imagination.
Yes.
There, I think you can fall back on the old rule that love your enemies because they tell you your faults. And in the academic world, Mircea Eliade and others who do that will have lots of, if not enemies, critics, their own generation, and especially the new generation coming up, who are generally very fertile sources of constructive criticism for me. The prior generation. But I would hope that they then would be willing to exert some of their critical, sensitive, interpretive abilities and not get so enthusiastic with the negative critique side of things that they perhaps even strangle themselves as well as limit their ability to appreciate what's going on 1,000 years ago or in the fellow down the street who's new religion you want to study.
Indeed, I completely agree with that.
Yeah, I guess imagination, phenomenologist, but not a very good one. I've given in too much to the negative side of things. I appreciate those who are still more poetic.
That's right. I think poetry is important in this. And Eliade, I mean, I think he's still the best book of Indian religions ever written, I think, Eliade, Yoga.
And he certainly had a kind of discipline in there, but he had a discipline that was looking, you could sort of smell out what it is that you want to find and then put into intelligible, critiquable categories.
He did. He's come under a lot of criticism.
I feel that Wilfred Smith, in a much less poetic way, also has that kind of sensitivity to what's going on.
That's terribly important, sensitivity. I think they were taking on board, I mean, I don't think particularly consciously, but indirectly anyway, this notion of racketing and so on, and suspension of the judgments about the being behind appearances. Mm. In order to be left with the appearances to consciousness, the religious appearances in particular.
You made a very good point, at least for me it was a very good one. It should have struck me long ago, but it struck me as forcefully as it did now. And that of bracketing the ontological aspects of whatever it is you're studying versus bracketing who you are personally.
Yeah.
I think that was not clear in my experience, and I've tended to bracket and eliminate myself much, which means, among other things, you are strangling your own poetic sensibility.
Yes, indeed. Mm. Indeed.
I appreciate that comment that you made toward the end.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding in British phenomenology of what bracketing is.
But when we say bracketing the objectivity or the ontological aspects, then does that mean bracketing truth claims about the religion, or is there something more than that? Does that also mean bracketing? Is there anything objective about religions that could be bracketed?
Yeah, it means that. It means bracketing the claims about, say, God is a trinity or something, or Shiva is blue or whatever. Bracketing and suspending questions about the truth of those things. So you're left with appearances.
Great. This idea of eidetic reduction of idols, I was a little wondering about that. Does Husserl think that these categories or these essences are there in the consciousness itself, or do they belong to the natural world? I'm thinking also about, for example, in Nihil philosophy, there is also this very strong idea that there is a kind of intuition. Mm. And these categories are actually there in nature, but they do accept a transcendental world a little bit with ideas and pure forms like
that.
That's
a very good question. I wonder.
But how does Husserl understand this intuition? Is it something within consciousness itself, or is something that reflects something outside?
I think there's an ambiguity there, actually. I think he thinks fundamentally it's in consciousness itself.
Yeah.
But he rejected the notion of a Platonic ideas which are external to consciousness.
Yes, you mentioned it. That's why I was wondering.
Yeah. So I think he would want to say, are these natural categories? It's a very interesting question. He's not a constructionist. He's not a cultural constructionist. So he thinks that there are inherent categories within the mind, you know, that he wants to promote, or wants to understand, rather, not promote.
Can you tell us something about Merleau-Ponty's critique of this eidetic reduction? What is he actually?
Yeah, well, Merleau-Ponty, I can't remember where, but he rejects this notion of the eidos, of the essence, because what you have is being in the world, and this is the reality that we're embodied beings in the world and into subjectivity. So he rejects any notion of some transcendental realm, either of the ego or the. I guess you've got two levels, haven't you? You've got level one of you've got the world, if you like, which is where you've got the appearances, and then you've got the transcendental realm, if you like, for Husserl, which is where you've got the transcendental ego and the eidos and the objects and the essences of the objects in the world. And Merleau-Ponty just rejects that whole transcendental move that's made by the phenomenon by Husserl.
So if I understand well, the way you presented is that Husserl is trying to not overcome the dichotomy between materialism and idealism, but more to integrate them, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, he's trying to
integrate
just
them.
He's trying to integrate them. So what you're left with is appearances, like we just read in that passage, which I think he is one of the clearest expressions of what he's trying to do. And so the rest of his life, he starts, he does that, and it's a mapping, a description of human experience, really, that he attempts. Cognition, time, perception.
I was wondering, is the transcendental ego like a noumenal being, or is it more like a formal sort of Kantian unity of apperception?
Yeah, it's a Kantian unity of apperception, I think, really. Yeah. It's a reflexive consciousness that can't reflect on itself any further.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it's pure because it can't be divided anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's the self without an object, I suppose, or it's the self behind the cogito and the cogitationes. It's the deeper self, if you like.
But its ontological status is itself bracketed. Is it its own?
Well, you can't do that.
You can't do that.
That's what he says.
Sure.
So you try and do it, but you can't. You can't do that. You can only bracket out the being behind the appearances to consciousness. You can't bracket the being of the cogito in the self, which is this deeper sense of self. We call it transcendental ego. Which is slightly puzzling. I mean, what does he mean by it? Is it in time? Is the transcendental ego in time, or is it outside of time? Is it like a pure Atman? Is it like that?
Sounds a bit like a Purusha.
It's like a Purusha, it is, yeah. In fact, who was that Indian philosopher? K.C. Bhattacharya. He was influenced by himself. He said it was like that. Transcendental ego is like the Purusha itself.
I mean, hearing what you're saying, and particularly reading this passage, I'm kind of almost inclined to say that Shankara is getting quite close to this, or yourself to Shankara, or whatever way.
Mm.
Would you think that, you know, with Shankara accepts the world as sort of, I mean, he says it's neither existing nor not existing, but it exists as an object of our perception, and in that sense it exists. But whether, you know, he doesn't really want to say whether the world objectively exists or not. He kind of leaves that a bit open.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the language might be a bit misleading. But particularly the last point that you have up there of the transcendental reduction, kind of the pure consciousness and so on, to me, kind of, I mean, maybe they're talking about something different, but it sort of reminds me of that. Would you say that's a fair...
Yeah, I think it's a fair parallel, really. But I think other people have picked up on it. I think Bhattacharya did, I think others. I think there's a close... I suspect phenomenology is a style of thinking, although it has a... I've described its roots here in Husserl and so on, but I suspect... I mean, many have argued that Indian philosophy is very close to phenomenology, and I think that there are parallels there. So I suspect... I had an experience where I taught a course in Virginia, actually, with Michael Peter Oakes, who is a semiotician. And we looked at phenomenology and semiotics. And we read Hebrew script texts and the Upanishads in translation through the lens of these philosophies, if you like. And the Indian material seemed to fit much more easily with phenomenology than the other way around. So we started to think that maybe semiotics comes out of Jewish thinking anyway. And phenomenology is kind of very much, much closer to Indian thinking. It's interesting.
It's interesting because one of the things that came up for me, and it's not something I know well, but and I'm not sure where it could go, is when you talk about the sign theorists, you know, and their critique of phenomenology, that whole premise that consciousness isn't primary, but that the system of signs is primary.
Yeah.
Seems to me, it reminds me a lot of the Matrika Shakti in like Kashmir Shaivism, where basically what they're saying is, where basically, if I understand it right, the sort of phenomenal world is essentially a system of signs. Mm. More
that's
or less.
A good point, yeah.
You know what I mean? It can get like much more esoteric than that, but the self, you know, the individual self is constructed of those signs.
Yeah.
But the reality of Shiva or that is beyond signification, and that the self is beyond signification. So you're sort of looking at the same thing from different ends.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On that model, then you've got the system of signs, which refers to culture and so on. It's one level of description, but a deeper level of description is phenomenological, really, which is a transcendental pure self or something that underlies appearances. It's interesting, yeah. So you'd have to have a... Yeah. On that level, the phenomenology still wins, as it were, isn't it? In a way.
It seems a difference if we're comparing with Advaita is that, if I understand well what you said, that phenomenology wanted to suspend the search for being,
yeah,
and takes appearances seriously,
yeah,
which is fundamental for descriptive kind of research. But then there is the problem of, like in Indian philosophy, the problem of understanding being, it's essential, like in the Upanishad and Advaita Vedanta, the understanding of what is beyond the appearances. Mm. So it seems like, somewhere or other that Husserl, there is a kind of a little conflict, epistemological conflict, because knowing well that we are studying appearances, we are not really reaching to being. Mm. Then actually we are not really reaching to any real fundamental bottom, so to speak. We are not really looking for what is behind the appearances. Mm. So even epistemologically, it's a weaker position in one sense compared to Indian philosophical position that consider appearances to be merely external or even illusory and want to go beyond them. Mm. Isn't that... I'm just brainstorming
right.
here.
I think there's a fundamental problem. I mean, he does. He sticks with appearances. He spends his life wanting to map out appearances, and but he does begin to speak about what he calls a genetic phenomenology towards the end of his life, which is trying to understand the something deeper than that first level. He starts talking about God. They all do, don't they?
At the end of their lives.
The transcendental self standing outside the life world.
Finally coming up.
Self-internalization. Self-internalization.
Yeah. The self-internalization. Yeah. I suppose he does talk about that.
But just to... I mean, for Shankara, the real notion of... You know what really exists is really it's to sort of the self as the observant of everything, because the self is pure consciousness, and the self he the Atma he equates with Brahman, and that's the only thing that exists. So yes. It's sort of in a sense. I mean that's why I was sort of seeing some parallels here, because he's not really concerned with whether the world is really there or not.
Right.
And he says it, in a sense, it isn't. But he's concerned with the appearance of the world, and the world exists insofar as we experience the world. Mm-hmm. And but then what he affirms as really existing, the thing that has a reality, is, he argues, is the self, which is the observer, which is that which perceives. So, and that I think there is more parallel.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's right. So this transcendental ego, I remember I had a conversation. Well, I've always understood this as individualistic, as or different transcendental egos, if you like. We're all different transcendental egos. Mm. But I was talking to Jamie Ferreira, who was puzzled by my understanding, because she always thought it was just one. Transcendental ego was one, very much exactly like Shankara, really. Mm. So it could be. I don't know which it is. Mm. I think it's ambiguous. And,
I have a question. Yes. Okay. So I still have some ambiguous idea about how we can bracket the objectivity of reality. Mm. So if we can bracket the reality, the objectivity, but if we have a knowledge about the appearance, then do we still constitute the appearance as a kind of secondary object?
Mm. The appearance as a secondary object. What's the primary object? The appearance.
It's reality.
The reality.
So we bracket this primary object, yeah. But yeah. Appearance functions as the kind of secondary object.
It does. Yeah. So what's the status of the secondary object? And how do you distinguish between real secondary objects and unreal secondary objects?
Mm-hmm.
Like unicorns. How do you distinguish between truth and reality on Husserl's account? What can he say? He says, then you have a consensus or the Lebenswelt, the life world, you have a kind of consensus within the life world of repeated appearances to consciousness. But do we not want a stronger account of reality than that? And you could argue that we do, and that you could argue science actually gives you that. So it's a really good question. I don't know how you can distinguish. If I've understood your question correctly, that you've bracketed out the first order, which is the being, the objective world, and you're left with all these appearances. So how do you differentiate between real ones and unreal ones?
But though he brackets the real world and the real being out, is he still kind of keeping the appearances in correspondence with the real world? Though he's not making a statement about it, but he doesn't get his appearances from pure imagination.
No.
But
no.
From the real world.
That's right. They're constitutive of the real world, yeah.
And that's where the cultural critique would come and say, but that is informed by your cultural presuppositions.
Mm. Good point. Yeah.
You can never make an epoch.
Yeah,
you can never bracket it out.
That's right. Mm. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think Bourdieu actually says that. Mm-hmm. I remember.
Yeah.
But
I'm very curious about this adiatic reduction, because I was thinking that in any, especially in humanities, any effort is actually, we are doing it intuitively always. We always come up with certain categories, as you have said. So all the categories that we come up with are, in a sense, that process of coming up with certain classifications, schemes that are a process of intuition.
It's way more organized than
yeah. And I've been thinking how Merleau-Ponty actually answered to that. I mean, what would be categories for him?
Yes, good point.
Yeah, how does he come up?
I don't remember. We read it. Do you remember when we read it?
No, that's what I'm asking.
Do you remember when we read Phenomenology of Perception? But
no.
How did he respond to that question?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I should probably.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is. Yeah. How does Merleau-Ponty divide up the world, and why is his way of dividing up the world better than his?
Yeah.
You'd have to say, of course, it corresponds to reality. But it's an interesting question of what Paul Fiddes and so on has talked about. What's primary in human experience? Are we born into a semiotic system? Is that the primary thing, or is the lived body the primary thing? So, in which case, a phenomenology is an appropriate way of understanding our lives, or are we born? Which is primary for us, a system of signs, or the experience of the lived body? Merleau-Ponty argues the experience of the lived body is prior to the system of signs.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Fiddes says no, it's the other way around. And what's the basis of the argument, either way?
Does Ricoeur kind of connect all the mimesis 1, 2, 3?
Oh yeah, he does, doesn't he? In his three levels of mimesis, yeah.
So from text to action, back to the text.
Yeah.
So
that's right. Pre-understanding.
Pre-understanding.
Well, his three levels of mimesis. Yeah. You mean? Yeah.
Which gets enacted then, then which is again captured in the text.
Yeah. Yeah. And the text is brought back to the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Husserl is still more towards the system of signs than the ontology. Anyway, we've gone on for long, 10 minutes over than we're supposed to. Or are we carrying on to 12:30? So I thought it was 3:00 we were supposed to stop. I'm happy to carry on.
The official time that it ends is half.
Oh, is it? Oh, we're carrying on then. So Phenomenology of Religion is... anyway, it's based on bracketing and Husserl and so on. It's come under a lot of criticism from critical theorists and so on. Ross McCutcheon, he was at Toronto, wasn't he, Ross McCutcheon?
Yes, he was one of our, not my personal students, but he was a student of our Centre for the Study of Religion.
Oh, right, that's right. Yeah.
So I guess we saw him, I think he was at the gathering of the International Society of History of Religion.
Oh, right, okay.
Ferdinando was there. Was anyone else at Toronto for the IAHR five-year gathering?
I've never been to them. Maybe I should go.
Last summer. Last summer, August.
Yeah.
We see a lot of the reference to Russell's work.
Yeah. I never met him.
And then, of course, there's Don Weeb, who organized the conference. He's had quite a few disciples of one sort or another with it, with the irony that he then finds himself as the Dean of Theology at Trinity College after having spent a better part of his career trying to keep theology out of religious studies.
That's so funny.
The real world is complicated.
Yeah.
But the last question that you had about the physical body, mind business versus the imposed languages. Small children typically get born without knowing a language, but they rather readily, if they're fortunate enough, have people around and they do learn a language, so their ways of thinking get shaped very much by the language that they have. But of course that is also malleable by more study and more language stuff, or they can have more physical experiences that tend to shift, am I going to really become a philosopher, or am I going to become an athlete? In my case, I became neither, I became an historian. Mm. But you've got the physical, organic part of you struggling in a way, or going along nicely with it. You have, I suppose, the possibility of meditational withdrawal, to some extent, temporarily, from the language systems that you have.
Mm.
But somehow, I would like to think that these things continue in some kind of a constructive tension. My comments earlier on, I guess, were more of the expecting that the poetic creativity is really rooted in the given physiological, neurological, whatever is there, that can be fed by good literary readings and language, but also can be cramped if you read the wrong things, you don't read enough good things, or whatever. So we end up, I don't opt on either side. They're somehow in a creative tension.
The creative tension between them. Yeah.
One thing is at the conference there was a very strong emphasis on cognitive science, the kind of the objective. And I think a kind of direct or indirect critique of phenomenology wasn't spelled out, but what would be, a good argument in defense of phenomenology in the context of, the contemporary academic? As I said, the turn toward objectivity and cognitive science is very strong nowadays.
Yes, it is,
and it's pushed by the attempt to try to accommodate humanities and social sciences in the natural sciences, which get a lot of attention and funds and so
Templeton funds and
so. But what would be good arguments for defending the process of phenomenology, taking appearances seriously? You mentioned also a critique insider accounts, phenomenology being too maybe sympathetic to the appearances, the views of the insiders, but this could also be a strength in one sense, because then it allows understanding more precisely specific human phenomena that cannot be really understood in a quantitative way. But what would be
I suspect that the contemporary argument would be very similar to the classical Husserlian argument against psychologism and scientism, that cognitive science attempting to explain human behavior in terms of cognition is scientism, and this, but you've got to be more careful these days because cognitive science, I mean, this is a objective knowledge about our brains and so on, has developed a pace over the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And so we understand a lot about the brain now that we didn't 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So you have to take that seriously, it seems to me. But I guess in the end, you could argue that you still need a phenomenological kind of account of human reality. Because that level of culture has a certain autonomy that is missed. You fundamentally miss something if you're explaining human reality purely in terms of cognition. Mm. So it's really a third-person accounts. Why should you privilege third-person accounts over first-person accounts? So flood sea fibers are firing. It's the Einsteinian thing that flood sea fibers are firing is not the same as I am in pain. They're different statements. Third person.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I think it's as simple as that in a way. That there is a valid ground for the humanities, and you have to defend the humanities rigorously against attempts to explain them in purely objectivist terms.
Mm-hmm.
Because human reality, I mean, why should you bother to do a PhD on French literature, you know, if all you need is to explain it neurologically?
And natural science also has had its history.
Yeah.
And it's changed over time.
Yeah.
So its structure has changed. There have been revolutions within it.
Indeed.
So they're not universal. So how can we guarantee that today's findings are going to be eternal?
Indeed. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I have found with, like, especially with cognitive anthropologists who do religion, that, I mean, they have even much more problem with introducing social and political issues in their explanations, much more than phenomenologists who went into this hermeneutical turn, who included more hermeneutics into their theory. So I think that's probably the biggest the biggest advantage of phenomenology, that it can kind of dovetail to the issues of politics and
yes,
much easily than actually cognitive science can.
Mm.
I mean, that's my humble view, but yeah.
Because there is arguably a reality of politics and sociology, and history, which has a certain autonomy independently of brain states,
And it's really difficult to kind of connected to the firing of neurons.
Yes.
Maybe the buffer in between.
For which areas of the brain light up when you're reading the Bible or something.
Yeah, it's interesting because it comes down to that distinction between, you know, the quantitative and the qualitative, and like the realm of the humanities is to deal with the qualitative. As opposed to the quantitative. But I remember reading that Richard Feynman said at one point that the future of physics, which it hit a wall quantitatively, was that it was going to have to start re-engaging with a quantitative or a qualitative sense of, you know, not so much like, for instance, even something along the lines of what are the qualities as we experience them of such and such an equation, even in order to find some new way of apprehending the universe or some more profound way of apprehending the universe. Even as the humanities are sort of defending themselves against, you know, scientism, you have these, you know, at least in certain areas, certainly not so much the neuroscientists, but science saying we have to import some of what's normally associated with the humanities, the sciences, to keep going forward, which is...
Yeah, like quantum physicists talking about the flavors of the particles.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. That's
flavors of the
subatomical exactly what Feynman was talking about.
Or colors
of the
particles.
The qualitative aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I wonder if there could be a strategic alliance between the humanists and the postmodernists. Now, the postmodernists have been after a lot of the... Western rationalist approach to doing things, but I don't think they were thinking much about neuroscience when they did that. They were thinking more about political, social, philosophical kind of arguments. But the kind of critique that they made of that, if something of that sort could be focused on the neuroscience kind of thing, with the humanist literary sensitivity, individual, in a way, the way some of the postmodernists would come from a particular national or gender or some other perspective and say you're not taking us seriously enough and we're showing your faults. If this somehow gets generalized to you aren't taking my humanness seriously enough, lots of humans around, those one answer, my God, everything's getting atomized there, you're nothing. But then again, you get enough nothings together and if they all claim to be human, you've got a rather strong force. This is
psychological pressure.
Psychological pressure, yeah.
Probably the right category, but somehow it's the strategic alliance of the effective critiques in a relatively modern setting.
Yeah,
humans haven't been very effective in defending themselves and critiquing things in recent times, so we may have to learn a bit from our more robust brothers and sisters, particularly, but get the women on this, because they're very, very good at critiquing male-dominated sort of things. They're pretty good at critiquing machine-dominated things.
That's right. That's very important, yeah. Because so you could argue that scientism is, or the modern cognitive approaches are kind of machine-dominated in a way. So, very interesting.
Of course, women, to some extent, the feminist stuff often says, stop talking to us as women is different from men. We have our political rights and so on and so forth. But then again, women still like men, but women are perhaps more aware of it, or should be. They do have a bodily, emotional side to them, and it's not as embarrassing for women, I suspect, to say my feelings are important. It's a little hard for men, apart from the Hare Krishna tradition, where they're very happy to express the sensitive side of things, but then the door is a little more cautious on it there. But there may be a strategic alliance, but we have to get a very effective women spokesman to lead the charge.
Well, indeed. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's hardly surprising that there are certain areas of the brain light up when you're doing certain kinds of activities, is it? But and it's obviously important, I suppose. It's interesting that there are that the brain does function in these ways, and that the religion is linked with the hippocampus or whatever they call it.
Not exhaustive. Religion is linked with the bodily sins, and the mind has to be developed in a religious way, so why can't we work on a hypothalamus or whatever it is in a good religious fashion? We're just learning a little bit more about the sense of the subtlety of the body.
Indeed, yeah.
Because there's that in our family, there's a funny kind of reversal of this. My wife, who was a Rabindranath Tagore scholar and has a great respect for his sense of education and the wholeness of education and poetry and all of this, has discovered some findings of neuroscience people that are suggesting that the kind of thing that Tagore was much interested in, music and the art in children's education, in fact, seems to result in a modern setting. If you have enough music and art in primary education, people end up more intelligent, effective.
Oh, really?
So she is, in the second edition of her book, Tagore the Poet's Educator, has this brief but mildly enthusiastic indicator that some of the neuroscience is, in fact, not validating, but coming in to reinforce what Rabindranath, with his creative imagination and awareness of his children and what they were like, already knew and has articulated in a very readable form.
It's interesting.
It's quite interesting.
Yeah.